The Tom Woods Show, episode 1907.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm beginning a series today of two episodes, and each of these will be standalone, so you can listen to each of them independently of the other, but it'll be more productive if you listen to this one first and episode 1908 second. What I'm doing is revisiting the financial crisis of 2008. And although I've covered this, obviously, on the show from time to time, because I did write the book Meltdown back in 2009, and that's before I started the podcast, but naturally, books you write become themes of your podcast over the years. This is probably the most detail I've gone into. And in particular, the next episode, 1908, will address specifically the claim that deregulation caused the crisis. We're going to get into very specific points about that so that your friends can't get away with that. Now, why am I talking about this all these years later? Well, think right now about the COVID situation we're living in. We definitely do not want our kids to grow up in a world in which they think, in which they read a textbook that tells them that Dr. Fauci saved the world, and then they just imbibe that. We don't want that to happen. We want there to be a strong, vigorous counter-narrative. Well, likewise, we need this too for the financial crisis of 2008, because if so-called capitalism is to blame, then we're going to do the wrong things. If we believe this idea that capitalism just, for some reason, inexplicably leads to housing booms and then busts, and well, you know, capitalism does bring home the goods, but you got to take the good with the bad because it does also give us these ups and downs. If that's the line we're going to accept, then we're going to do all the wrong things and we're going to make ourselves poorer. So I want to be part of that vigorous counter narrative. So two parts to this. As I say, this first part might be somewhat more familiar to regular listeners, but the second part will without a doubt have a lot of brand new information. But I think we can all benefit from hearing it all explained systematically. Now, early in his first term, Barack Obama, surveying the economy he inherited from George W. Bush, said this: "What I won't do is return to the failed theories of the last 8 years that got us into this fix in the first place, because those theories have been tested and they have failed," unquote. Now, of course, Obama never elaborated on what theories he had in mind. George W. Bush had been the biggest spending U.S. president since Lyndon Johnson, not exactly a sign of laissez-faire. So did Obama's repudiation of his predecessor mean he would cut spending? Did he mean deficits and the debt would be reduced? Did he mean he wanted the Federal Reserve to stop tinkering with interest rates? No president ever means any of this. Obama took all of these policies, and rather than reverse them, he doubled down on them. Change we can believe in. Remember that slogan? Change we can believe in. It turned out to mean more of the same, except worse. And what Obama was trying to say, of course, is that the supposedly free market policies of the past 8 years had failed. And that was the unanimous response of the political class. Why, the free market has once again gone haywire, and once again, just for your own good, you understand, we need more power and more of your wealth. Now, it was not the free market that failed us. It was a ginned-up housing market, overheated from political manipulation and artificially low interest rates courtesy of the Federal Reserve. Governments do not smooth out or eliminate business cycles. They cause and exacerbate them. Then they cite problems they themselves caused as good reasons for them to expand their authority. What happened to financial institutions is important, but it gets too far ahead of the story to try to figure out why so many of them went bust. The real question is why they went boom unnaturally in the first place. Had there been no artificial boom, there could have been no bust. Part of the story involves government intervention into the housing market. That's a story that's been told elsewhere, but the basic contours are worth revisiting. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs, whose mission was to make housing affordable. Although ostensibly private, Fannie and Freddie enjoyed special tax and regulatory privileges that other institutions did not. And it was generally assumed that if it ever came to that, the GSE's special line of credit at the Treasury would be transformed into a bailout in whatever amounts were required. These advantages allowed the GSEs to dominate the mortgage market. Fannie and Freddie could buy whole or securitized mortgages from banks, so that from that moment on, the mortgage would be handled by Fannie or Freddie instead of the originating bank. Now, by the way, I don't want to just assume that everybody knows what securitized mortgages are and what the term mortgage-backed securities means. So mortgage-backed securities were instruments in which a pool of mortgages were grouped into a financial product for sale to investors. So a mortgage involves a stream of payments over time that a homeowner makes. You pool a bunch of these together into a product, and you chop them up, and you sell the bits and pieces to investors. So each investor is getting a little piece of a bunch of pools of income being paid by various homeowners. So it really is just that. Each mortgage-backed security consisted of tiny fractions of a number of mortgages. And so strictly speaking, the holder of the mortgage-backed security is entitled to a tiny portion of the income stream from the various mortgage payments that came in for the mortgages bundled in the instrument. So now, back to Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie played an important role in creating a market for risky mortgages. And I'll explain in a minute what that means. And this is happening particularly as housing prices were beginning to climb in the late 1990s. From 1998 to 2003, Fannie and Freddie were the most frequent buyers of mortgage loans. So they would buy the mortgage loans, and then they would be entitled to the income streams coming from them. So defenders of Fannie and Freddie try to say that, after all, private lenders originated most of the mortgage loans that eventually went sour. But they're being disingenuous. If Fannie and Freddie had not stood ready to buy those loans from the originators, many of those loans wouldn't have been made in the first place. Countrywide, for example, sold about 90% of its loans to Fannie and Freddie. Now, as it turns out, Fannie and Freddie did not exactly have to be pushed into taking risk. Daniel Mudd was the CEO of Fannie Mae, and he once told company employees to, quote, get aggressive on risk-taking or get out of the company, unquote. We also have email correspondence that reveals that risk managers objected strenuously to these directives from senior management and warned that the GSEs would thereby lead the whole market down the road of overpricing risky mortgages. Well, how about that? That's exactly what happened. In the decade leading up to Fannie and Freddie's collapse in 2008, these two mortgage giants spent millions of dollars lobbying congressmen. Congressional districts across the country had affordable housing charities dotting the landscape. And so with comfortable sinecures available to the relatives of important politicians, the result was an American political class that was all too happy to do the bidding of Fannie and Freddie. And when Fannie Mae executives were caught in accounting scandals in 2004, they cooked their books to justify larger bonuses for themselves. Nobody went to jail, which would have happened in the case of a genuinely private firm. Now, thanks to this government guarantee, Fannie and Freddie had been able to operate with far more leverage than even the worst of the investment banks would later be criticized for. And again, I don't want to just throw around lingo. When we talk about leverage, if we say Fannie and Freddie were highly leveraged, we mean they had far too little capital on hand to make good on their obligations, and they could continue functioning only by constant borrowing. They had $83 billion in capital covering $5 trillion in liabilities, so their leverage ratio was more than 60 to 1. Now, as Fannie and Freddie were heading toward collapse in July of 2008, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, calmly observed that, quote, their regulator has made clear that they are adequately capitalized, unquote. Well, 2 months later, when Fannie and Freddie failed and were taken over by the U.S. government, some people wanted to revisit that statement by Hank Paulson. And here's how he got out of it. He said, quote, I never said the company was well capitalized. What I said is the regulator said they are adequately capitalized. I mean, can you believe it? That's a lizard person right there. Normal people don't act like that. Now, it is true, Fannie and Freddie did not enjoy an explicit bailout promise from the U.S. government. There was a slim chance that they would be allowed to go bankrupt, but the markets, which turned out to be correct, apparently didn't think that chance was very great. The U.S. government, which is considered the safest of safe investments, the U.S. government can borrow from the public at low interest rates. As late as September 2008, when Fannie and Freddie were at death's door, they were still able to borrow at rates only 1 percentage point higher than the federal government itself could. So investors obviously believed the federal government would come to the rescue. As a matter of fact, from 2000 to 2006, during the height of the housing boom, and at a time when Fannie and Freddie's risk grew considerably, their borrowing costs held steady with or even fell relative to those of the U.S. government. So at the time Fannie and Freddie were taken over by the federal government, we were told that a combined cap of $400 billion had been placed on how much assistance they could receive. Several months later, no more cap. It was removed. Taxpayer assistance to Fannie and Freddie would now be potentially unlimited. And I'm sure it was just a coincidence that that cap was removed on Christmas Eve, a day when nobody would be paying attention. Now, when everything went south, there were plenty of advocates for Fannie and Freddie and for the federal government in general that tried to claim they weren't responsible for this. They hadn't done anything to change the composition of lending in the United States. But the problem is they bragged about doing it, and nobody was correcting them when they were bragging. If they were bragging about doing something they weren't really doing, why didn't anybody say, hey, you're not actually doing that thing that you say you're doing? They took credit for the very things their defenders later on would try to pretend they didn't do. So in 2000, the Department of Housing and Urban Development declared, lower income and minority families have made major gains in access to the mortgage market in the 1990s. A variety of reasons accounted for these goals, including improved housing affordability, enhanced enforcement of the Community Reinvestment Act, more flexible mortgage underwriting, and stepped up enforcement of the Fair Housing Act. But most industry observers believe that one factor behind these gains has been the improved performance of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac under HUD, that is, Housing and Urban Development, HUD's affordable lending goals. HUD's recent increases in the goals for 2001 to 3 will encourage the GSEs to further step up their support for affordable lending. So here they are bragging about the very thing that Krugman and his allies would say, oh, they never did that. Then why didn't you correct them when they bragged about doing it? And then 4 years later, HUD added this. Over the past 10 years, there has been a revolution in affordable lending that has extended homeownership opportunities to historically underserved households. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been a substantial part of this revolution in affordable housing. During the mid to late 1990s, they added flexibility to their underwriting guidelines, introduced new low-down payment products, and worked to expand the use of automated underwriting in evaluating the creditworthiness of loan applicants. HMDA data suggests that the industry and GSE initiatives are increasing the flow of credit to underserved borrowers. Again, they're bragging about this. Nobody's correcting them. Andrew Cuomo was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under Bill Clinton, and he broadened the scope of the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, whose programs were supposed to help low-income people become homeowners. Cuomo nearly doubled the upper limit of FHA loans to $235,000. Then he reduced down payments to a mere 3% and more or less saw to it that home buyers could avoid paying even that. The Bush administration pushed things even further. As late as 2008, they increased the percentage of low-income and very low-income earners to a goal of 56%, whose mortgages Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were urged to buy. Every federal agency connected with housing leaned on lenders like this, and Fannie and Freddie, probably in the wake of Fannie's accounting scandals, were strongly pressured to expand their exposure to risky mortgages. Now, the other culprit the establishment tried without success to exonerate is the Federal Reserve System, the U.S. central bank that holds government-granted monopoly privileges. If the Fed had not repeatedly intervened to push interest rates lower than the market wanted to set them, the market would have stopped the housing bubble in its tracks. Faced with an inordinate demand for mortgage loans, banks would have found their supply of loanable funds rapidly depleted. As a result, interest rates would have shot up and further speculation in real estate would have been arrested. These high interest rates would also have encouraged people to save, and those increased savings would have provided the genuine wherewithal for any further home lending to take place. The role of the Fed was much more significant than that of the U.S. government itself, since without the wherewithal to finance these home purchases, attempts to manipulate the housing market on the political side would have hit a natural brick wall. Asset bubbles, which involve goods whose prices are unsustainably high for long periods of time, should always incline us to look for monetary mismanagement. When demand for a particular asset, like in this case houses, rises, this increased demand pushes its price above the level it would otherwise have reached. But in a bubble, people keep buying the asset, even though its price goes on rising, without a contraction in other sectors of the economy. So where does all the money come from to make the ever-rising prices of the bubble possible, such that people can continue buying the asset even as its price goes through the roof? That's where the monetary spigot comes in. When money is cheap, the purchase of assets of ever-increasing price becomes possible. Looking back on the dot-com boom of the late 1990s, The Economist magazine wrote this, quote, "Without easy credit, the stock market bubble could not have been sustained for so long, nor would its bursting have had such serious consequences. And unless central bankers learn their lesson, it will happen again," unquote. The artificially high prices in the U.S. housing market fed on themselves. Artificially high home prices made it more and more difficult for the average person to buy a home. In some parts of the country, people earning the median income couldn't afford a median-priced home. The result was the creative financing schemes that would later cause so much grief, with people who were otherwise unable to crack into such an inflated housing market lying about their income or employment status, taking out no-doc mortgages, which meant they didn't have to provide any documentation of income. Things like this, in order to cope with the high prices. The down payment, which once served to give a buyer a stake in his house, give him skin in the game, began to disappear. By 2005, 43% of first-time buyers made no down payment, and 68% were putting less than 10% down. This kind of activity drove up prices still further, and the cycle continued. All right, let me interrupt myself for just a minute to do something that's going to help an awful lot of you. I know there are a lot of people out there struggling with depression and anxiety, dealing with family conflicts, self-esteem problems, and social media doesn't help things because it looks like everybody has a perfect life. One of the Tom Woods Show episodes I got the best feedback from was when Michael Malice and I, who frankly have a lot of things going for us, honestly admitted the struggles that we've had. So you're not alone, and there is help. The amazing folks at BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. You can send messages to your counselor anytime. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. And in fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/woods. The allegedly laissez-faire, Ayn Randian Alan Greenspan, Federal Reserve Chairman from 1987 to 2005, found nothing wrong with the decline in lending standards. In fact, he said in his 2008 autobiography, quote, "I was aware that the loosening of mortgage credit terms for subprime borrowers increased financial risk and that subsidized home ownership initiatives distort market outcomes. But I believed then, as now, that the benefits of broadened home ownership are worth the risk," unquote. Well, that didn't age well. Then meanwhile, there's all this propaganda being spread saying that real estate is a great investment, housing prices never fall. People had the impression that housing prices never fell, by the way, because during the recession of 2001, the Federal Reserve just refused to let the correction occur and just kept pumping credit into the system. And so even during a recession, housing starts increased, which is the first time ever since we've been recording data about U.S. recessions. So that fed into this myth that housing prices don't fall, housing is the best investment you can make. And when a lot of these mortgages turned out to be quite sour, people couldn't make the payments on them, then all these financial instruments based on these mortgages turned out to be dramatically overvalued, and now you have institutions that are in massive trouble because they have a ton of these on their books. It's quite revealing that Paul Krugman, the New York Times House economist, complained about how many people are, quote, asking how we got into this mess rather than telling us how to get out of it, unquote. But that is the central question. How are you going to get out of it if you don't know what got you into it? Well, we talked in a recent episode about the Austrian theory of the business cycle. This is the theory that won F.A. Hayek the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974. And it tries to explain why it is that the economy moves in a boom-bust cycle. And it places the culprit on, well, in the modern case, central banking, because it's the central bank that directs the process that the Austrian school identifies as the culprit. So there are two scenarios I want you to think about. And if you understand the difference between these scenarios, you'll understand this theory of the business cycle, which, by the way, this theory of the business cycle has as its implicit lesson that capitalism, quote unquote, is not the culprit in business cycles, even though we've all been taught that it is, even though a lot of free market people think it is. Actually, it isn't. So stop blaming it for them. So here's the first scenario. Let's think about what happens when the public starts saving more. Now the banks have more funds to lend because the public is saving more, putting the money in the bank. And so now the rate of interest they charge on loans will fall. These lower interest rates stimulate an expansion in long-term investment projects. Long-term investment projects are more interest rate sensitive than short-term ones. So considerably more money in interest payments is paid over the life of a long-term than a short-term project, thanks to compound interest. So if interest rates go down, it makes these kinds of projects seem disproportionately attractive. Now, let me introduce one concept to you, and that is the idea of the structure of production. This is how Austrians think about the economy and capital. In that structure, we have lower order stages of production. These are stages closer to finished consumer goods, so retail stores, services, and the like. Wholesale and marketing are stages of higher order than these. And then mining, construction, and research and development are of still higher order, since what they're doing is so remote from the finished good that reaches the consumer. All right, now back to our first scenario. The public has increased its savings. The other side of the coin when the public increases its saving is that it's consuming less. So when people consume less, well, that's a perfect time for higher order stages of production to expand. So you have people's additional saving. Well, so there's less demand, relatively speaking, for consumer goods. They're not buying as many of them right now because they're saving. So lower order stages of production are going to contract, relatively speaking, and that'll release resources for use in the higher order stages. So in other words, if people are saving more and they're buying fewer hats or decks of playing cards, then the hat and playing card industries will need fewer trucks, less gasoline, fewer employees, and so on. An employee who answered the phones at the playing card factory, for example, can get a job filing work orders for a contractor as construction increases. The goods and employees released by consumer goods industries like these are now available to make possible the completion of the higher order projects that the low interest rates have made more attractive to entrepreneurs. The lower order stages contract, thereby making possible the expansion of the higher order stages. So in short, when interest rates are free to fluctuate, they coordinate production across time and ensure that the configuration of the production structure is sustainable. Long-term production is begun only when sufficient savings are available to fund it. Now let's consider scenario two, or shall I call it evil scenario two. Government-established central banks have various means at their disposal to force interest rates lower even without any corresponding increase in saving by the public. So now, just as in the case in which public saving has increased, the lower interest rates, in this case, caused by artificial intervention into the economy by the Fed, spur expansion in higher order stages of production. But the difference is a critical one, and it guarantees that these artificially low interest rates will not yield the happy coordination from our first scenario. So in this case, people have not decreased their consumption spending. If anything, the low interest rates on loans encourage further consumption. If consumption spending is not constricted, the lower order stages of production do not contract. And if they do not contract, they do not release resources for use in the higher order stages of production. So therefore, the economy is inadvertently arranged in an unsustainable configuration. The public does not want this ratio of higher order to lower order production. Not enough resources exist to fund both the lower order production the public wants and the wave of higher order projects the economy has been misled into initiating. So instead of harmonious economic development, there will ensue a tug of war for resources between the higher and lower stages. In the process of this tug of war, the prices of these resources, labor, trucking services, etc., will be bid up as the various firms and industries compete for them, thereby threatening the profitability of higher order projects that were begun without the expectation of this increase in costs. What all this means is that the economy-wide discoordination that reveals itself in the bust is not caused by the free market. To the contrary, its intervention into the free market, in the form of distortions of the structure of interest rates, which are crucial coordinating mechanisms, that causes the problem. Production projects that are interest rate sensitive, housing among them, are given artificial and unhealthy stimulation that eventually reverses itself in losses and bankruptcies. As the boom turns into bust, the economy tries to readjust itself into a configuration that conforms to consumer preferences. That's why it is so essential for government to stay entirely out of the adjustment process, because arbitrary government behavior can only delay this necessary and healthy process. Wages and prices need to be free to fluctuate so labor and other resources can be swiftly shifted away from bloated bubble sectors of the economy and into sustainable sectors of the economy where consumers want them. Bailouts obstruct this process by preventing the reallocation of capital into the hands of firms that genuinely cater to consumer demand, and instead propping up those firms that have deployed resources in ways that do not conform to consumer preferences. Fiscal and monetary stimulus, therefore, do nothing to address the imbalances in the economy and only perpetuate them. Now, note that the problem is not a decline in consumer spending that needs to be reversed through various government stimuli to consumption. To the contrary, there's too much consumer spending. It's the relatively high consumer spending that is pulling factors of production back from the higher to the lower order stages of production. Stimulating consumption only makes the situation worse by squeezing the already collapsing profitability of the higher order stages. There's no improving on Ludwig von Mises' metaphor of the master builder, which we reviewed in a recent episode. An economy stimulated by artificially low interest rates is like a master builder engaged in the task of building a house that he lacks the materials to complete. If he discovers his error right away, he can limit the damage. Maybe only a small part of the house will have to be knocked down. Maybe none of it will. Maybe he can just alter his blueprint for the rest of the house in light of the decreased supply of building materials he now knows are available to him. What we do not want to do, in the name of helping him, is to get him drunk to the point where he doesn't notice his depleted supply of building materials until he has laid his very last brick. Now he's in a far worse situation. Probably now the whole house has to be torn down, and all the materials and labor hours he expended on the project will have been squandered forever. The artificially stimulated economy is like the master builder in that it, too, has become too ambitious in the face of the real level of resources at its disposal. Higher order stages of production are being encouraged to expand at a time when no corresponding contraction has occurred in the lower order stages, which indeed may actually be expanding. This cannot go on forever. The story of the master builder also reveals the critical point that the real problem occurs during the boom period, not the bust. The artificial boom gives the superficial impression of prosperity. Why, the master builder is employed and he's producing goods for consumer use. But it's during the boom that resources are misallocated. That is to say, when the master builder squanders building materials on a house he can never complete. The bust is the moment when his errors come to light and he realizes he must modify his activities. Likewise, the economy that as a whole appears to be prospering during a boom, and some of what occurs during the boom is indeed the generation of real wealth, is in fact engaged in a misdirection of resources. The bust or recession, painful as it is the necessary stage whereby resources are redeployed to lines of production that satisfy real consumer demand. Most observers cheered in the months following 9/11 when it seemed as if Alan Greenspan had successfully navigated the economy through the dot-com bust at the cost of only a relatively mild recession. The man the New York Times identified as, quote, the infallible maestro of our financial system, unquote, had lived up to expectations. But as I suggested earlier, all Greenspan's interventions did was hold off the inevitable recession and make the downturn of 2007 and beyond all the worse. The recession of 2001 was the only one on record in which housing starts did not decline. From 2000 to 2001, home prices actually increased 8.8%. Austrian economist at the time wondered about this. James Grant, who's been a guest on this show, said at the time, "What could explain a bull market in a non-earning asset in a non-inflationary era?" And he believed the answer was artificial credit expansion and artificially low interest rates. So people drew the false conclusion, amplified by the alleged experts, including some Fed economists, that the housing sector is robust through thick and thin. Housing prices never fall. A house is the best investment someone can make, and so on. And so because Greenspan would not allow the full correction to take place, clearing out entrepreneurial errors caused by his previous fiddling with interest rates, market actors persisted in their errors for years thereafter. And so with the economy having continued along this unsustainable trajectory all that time, the bust that inevitably came was that much worse. The Austrian theory of the business cycle strongly implies what should be done once the bust hits. Certainly all inflation of the money supply has to come to an end, because it was that policy that brings artificially lower interest rates in its train that caused the misdirection of resources into unsustainable lines in the first place. Further misdirection, even if we dignify it with the word stimulus, will not repair the broken economy. Prices and wages need to be free to fluctuate in accordance with changing conditions. The price system is the outcome of trillions of buying and selling decisions by businesses and the public. Entrepreneurs who are trying to figure out how to combine factors of production in such a way as to produce the goods consumers want at the lowest possible cost to society must refer to it. Any interference with prices and wages during the critical time in which bust evolves into recovery will subvert and thus delay the economy's adjustment process. Only an unhampered system of prices and wages can ensure that misallocated resources, including labor, those misallocated resources from the boom, are redirected to sectors of the economy where they conform to, rather than stand in inadvertent defiance of, consumer demand. During a boom, labor and physical resources are attracted to sectors where it is later discovered they did not belong. During the housing boom, some 40% of all new jobs were in the housing sector. That could not continue. Failing firms need to be allowed to go bankrupt. The structure of production undergoes considerable change during the recession period, and the sustainable pattern of consumption and production that results will not permit all firms to continue as before. Bankruptcy permits new owners to take over the assets of failing firms and either conduct those firms according to a different business model, turn the assets, if possible, toward the production of different goods, or simply sell off the assets and compensate as many of the creditors as can be accommodated. Further, the government's predation on the economy in the form of spending and taxation should be reduced. Resources are thereby released that entrepreneurs can use to realign the capital structure in light of the changed conditions that the bust brought to light. And this strategy was followed in the Depression of 1920 to 21, which I've talked about several times on the Tom Woods Show. That depression saw unemployment shoot up to 12.4% and production decline by 17%. Wholesale prices fell by 56%. The political class today would be screaming for all kinds of stimulus to reverse this death spiral. But the federal government at the time cut its budget in half from 1920 to 1922 and cut the national debt by one-third over the course of the 1920s. Income tax rates were lowered for all income groups throughout the decade, but these lower taxes took effect after the recovery was already in progress. The Federal Reserve, for its part, did not engage in open market operations, which is what it does to increase the amount of credit in circulation and push interest rates down. The economy was allowed to adjust without the so-called counter-cyclical government policies that we're told are essential. By the late summer of 1921, signs of recovery were evident, and that's when the National Bureau of Economic Research says the Depression ended. And Joseph Schumpeter, one of the eminent economists of the 20th century, said that the 1920 to 21 case, quote, shows better than any theory could how the system pulls itself out of troughs under its own steam, unquote. William Graham Sumner said in 1896, no scheme which has ever been devised has ever made a collapsed boom go up again. Nothing in the historical record has done anything to change that verdict. All right, that's episode one for you. Episode two is then going to go into the claim that all this happened because of deregulation, because they repealed regulations that were keeping the economy on an even keel. Well, we're going to get into that and just explode that tomorrow. So stay tuned for that. If you like and appreciate what I'm doing, I would love to welcome you into the supporting listeners group. You get a great many benefits, and now an additional benefit is a special reception at the 2000th episode event I'm having in Orlando, just for folks like you. The event is for the general public, but the reception is to thank supporting listeners of the show, and only you guys can get in there. So to become a supporting listener of the show, check out supportinglisteners.com. You get membership into the Tom Woods Show Elite, which in your heart you know you want. So go check out supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.